Hi, this is Arnie Arneson, and this is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. I'm going to remind you, because it's going to be really important given how quickly news is changing on the political landscape, we are Zooming the show at 10 a.m. on Monday morning. I'm sure a lot will happen between now and Tuesday. At least, if nothing else, you have the background for this interview. Before we begin with a fabulous limerick by Anthony Tenzer. He is our Calvin Trillin. He does fabulous political limericks. And Dave, I want you to hit it with the music.
Istanbul was Constantinople. Now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, now it's Turkish delight on a moonlit night.
He's been setting this up for ages, sowing election fraud theory in stages because he can't lose. He's got lying Ted Cruz and his base on the street enraging.
People just liked it better that way.
So, Constantinople, no, you can't go back to Constantinople. Been a long time gone. Constantinople, why did Constantinople get the work?
Welcome to the program, Mel Goodman. He is our first guest of, really, you're the first guest of 2021. We did a rethink yesterday, so it was sort of a panel, but Mel, you get the honors.
The news has the half-life of yogurt these days, but go ahead.
Mel, your background is enormous. I want you to share with my audience, how would you describe your life? I can read it to you. But I want you, given what you know of that landscape, to say, this is who Mel Goodman is.
I'm a policy wonk who spent 24 years at the CIA and believes that the government should be sharing what they call classified information with the American people because it's our information. It was collected by us with our money for our security. So what I've been doing, without compromising American national security or sovereignty or integrity, is talking as much as I can about what the government thinks is classified, but what I think is unclassified, so that the American people have a better understanding of international security and can debate these issues. So when these clowns run for government, and of course, to call Trump a clown doesn't really capture this pathological president, I think we have a better understanding of what's at stake here. And there are tremendous interests and equities that are clearly at stake. So I'm doing what I can to educate the people. That's why I was a whistleblower in 1991 against Robert Gates, who was falsifying intelligence throughout the 1980s, and kept on as a Secretary of Defense by Barack Obama, who should have known better, for crying out loud. So this is what I do.
Good. I'm so glad I asked that question.
And that's also, by the way, why I'm suing the CIA for restricting my First Amendment rights. But that's another story.
All right, we'll talk to your lawyer about that. What I'm thinking about is, as you were talking about the fact that there's too much information that is not made public, we know that we're coming on the air right after this like historic phone call that apparently happened on Saturday between Donald Trump and the Georgia Secretary of State. And a lot of people are saying his privacy was violated. This was a conversation between him and a private conversation with the Secretary of State. Of course, there were about 9 other people listening online that were part of this conversation. I keep thinking, as you point out, that there is so much information that the public should know. When a sitting president elected is talking to a sitting Secretary of State elected, what part of this conversation should I not know? I mean, I hate to break it to you. Even the idea that this information and this conversation should not have been disclosed. I mean, imagine if it wasn't and Donald Trump got to spin it, but we got to hear it. And the hour and 5 minutes is just beyond comprehensible. But if nothing else, it points out why we need sunlight, why we need information, because it's how we process not only what we know about our country, but how we choose to pick our elected leaders.
Well, and I think of what Adam Schiff said at the end of the impeachment trial, which was also about another phone call that Trump did his best to hide from the American people. And thank God for the CIA whistleblower who came from my old office in the Directorate of Intelligence, and the brave Army Colonel Vindman, who paid for what he did with his entire career. We wouldn't have had that information. And Adam Schiff said, if right no longer matters, we're lost. And if truth no longer matters, then we're lost. And that's what's at stake here. What is right? What is correct? What is legal? What is constitutional? What is truth? And we have a president who engages not just in falsehoods, but there's something so demented. When I read as much of that text and listened to it, of that phone call, this is a sick dude. Let's be honest here. And we should have known that in 2016, but yet in 2020, he picked up 10 million more votes. What does that say about us? What does that say about the American people? Why are we so uneducated? What can we do to correct that? Why don't we teach civics anymore in schools? Why can't we get back to school? There's so much at stake here now that I find it frightening. I feel like I've lived through the golden ages, and I feel sorry for my 13 grandchildren who are going to grow up really in lesser times where what we know about governance and democracy and all the rights in terms of personal liberty have been compromised by this one individual and cronies like Mark Meadows and Rudy Giuliani and Jared Kushner. This is pathetic. What has happened to this country? You know, Barack Obama kept saying, this is not who we are. Well, let's prove that. That's not who we are. Act like it. It's not who we are. So far, I'm quite disappointed.
You mentioned the number of votes that Donald Trump got compared to what he got in 2016 after 4 years of experiencing Donald Trump. You could say, well, he was a talk show host or he was a reality TV guy who claimed he was a billionaire. And so people played to a populist base, no question. And Hillary Clinton, I think, assumed it was hers. And she unfortunately ran a campaign with that assumption. And it turned out she lost. I was on C-SPAN on January 1st. I was the first guest of the Washington Journal on C-SPAN Friday. And one of the things I said to the audience was, but let's not forget, it was a celebration of democracy, sort of. Look at how many people voted. And I pointed out the 81 million votes that Joe Biden got. I said, but let's be sobering about this, because Donald Trump got the second highest number of votes in U.S. history, and he got 74 million votes. I said, so if nothing else, all we know is we have a divided nation.
And people divided chose nation, and we also have a corrupt system, because if you look at Hillary Clinton's loss, she gained nearly 3 million more votes than Donald Trump, but the crucial votes were the 77,000 votes in the so-called blue belt. Well, if you look at this election, which Biden won by 7 million votes, there were 63,000 votes in Georgia, Arizona, and Wisconsin, and the second congressional district of Nebraska. If they had gone differently, Trump would have had another 4 years. This is frightening. Look what it turns on. What did the founding fathers, why did they do this to us?
I got to clip that, what you just said, because I forgot to think about it that way, that when you actually count the number of votes that made a difference in those states to deliver the electoral college vote, it's a small suburb.
Exactly.
I mean, let's think about it. That's what decided this vote. And I think, again, for people who are concerned about the electoral college, which really was an embrace of the Civil War, it was an embrace of the idea of, you know, keeping the South strong and giving the rest of us sort of the shaft. It makes no sense, especially when you look at the power of these small, small, rural, unpopulated parts of the country. They have such influence on the results of our election. It's just frightening.
So 10 years after the Constitution was promulgated, James Madison was asked about the Electoral College. You know, why did you do it? And he said, well, you know, we were really tired at that point and we got impatient. They knew what they were doing. Alexander Hamilton talked about the tyranny of the majority. They were elitists, white, male, elitists with property, and they were going to run everything. And here we are.
All right. So I called you up and I was talking about a little bit about the influence of the pandemic on our foreign policy. As I was getting ready for this interview, I decided to look at the Carnegie Endowment for International Peace. And there was a name that jumped out at me, who's the president of that, and that's William Burns. And you had actually mentioned William Burns as someone who should be appointed to Biden's cabinet. But what I wanted to do is just read you a couple of sentences from his article that he wrote, A New U.S. Foreign Policy for the Post-Pandemic Landscape, okay? And William Burns writes, as the global order crumbles, the United States must reinvent its role in the world. And he says, it is tempting to draw sweeping conclusions about what geopolitics will look like after the coronavirus pandemic. Some argue that we're witnessing the last gasp of U.S. primacy, the equivalent of Britain's 1956 Suez moment. Others argue the U.S., the main driver of the post-Cold War international order, is only temporarily incapacitated with a president drunk at the wheel. Tomorrow, a more sober operator can swiftly restore its leadership. There is a lot we don't know yet about the virus or how it will reshape the international landscape. What we do know is that we have drifted into one of those rare periods of transition. The U.S. dominance in the rearview mirror, anarchic order looming dimly beyond. The moment resembles, in both of its fragility and its geopolitical and technological dynamism, the era before World War I, which triggered two global military convulsions before statecraft finally caught up with the magnitude of the challenges. This is so frightening. To navigate today's complicated transition, the U.S. will need to move beyond the debate between reentrenchment and restoration and imagine a more fundamental reinvention of its role in the world. And here is the powerful last line. We have drifted again into one of those rare periods of transition with U.S. dominance in the rearview mirror and a more anarchic order looming dimly beyond. And I said it before, and I want to say it again. I think it's so sobering, and I really do hope he's part of the administration, because Biden sees himself as a foreign policy president. I need to make sure that, therefore, he's a good foreign policy president and not one that assumes a past that really doesn't reflect our future.
Well, I think of what Franklin Roosevelt said in terms of the leading power of the presidency, he said, is moral leadership. And in Donald Trump, we, of course, have just the opposite. So now, if there's going to be any legitimacy in the international community, a real international community, and at the time of a pandemic, we've never needed more an internationalization, a globalization of policymaking and leadership, it's going to have to be the United States. I hate to say that because I don't think we are that exceptional nation that we claim to be, and we're certainly not what Madeleine Albright referred to as the indispensable nation. But I go back to that wonderful period from 1945 to 1950 that Dean Acheson, Secretary of State Dean Acheson, recorded so well in his book, President of the Creation. And a lot of people said that was a pompous title. Well, no, it wasn't, because that was the great 5 years of American diplomacy, American leadership, American moral leadership in the international community. And we need that again. And when you look at what not only the pandemic has done, but really it's the last 10 years, we haven't recovered from the financial crisis of 2008, which led to a real tendency, propensity toward nationalism and alternationalism. And so if you look at the leaders around the world, whether it's Modi in India, Abe when he was in Japan, Putin in Russia, Xi Jinping in China, Trump in the United States, these are ultra-nationalists. America First is essentially an isolationist policy at the time of a pandemic and a financial challenge that needs internationalization. And I think nothing symbolized it more than the 28th of January, 2020, when Trump's intelligence briefers told him that there is a pandemic loose in China. That's when he got the information. 2 days later, he took the United States out of the World Health Organization. He brought home our representatives from the World Health Organization in 2019. When John Bolton was National Security Advisor, he blew up the pandemic office, the global security office that was designed by the Obama administration to deal with the pandemic that was predicted by Bill Gates in a TED talk in 2015. I remember the TED talk by Gates said, at some point millions of people are going to be dead, and it won't be because of nuclear war. It'll be because of a pandemic. This is the existential problem we have to deal with, not nuclearization and modernization and our hundreds of bases and facilities around the world. It's dealing with real world problems. And we have one now at the time we have a pathological president. What could be worse?
You mentioned Dean Acheson's book, and you said it was somewhat arrogant, but he was absolutely right about that. So five-year window. This is also a pivotal time. We have an opportunity to change our next five-year window, okay? Mm. We can use the pandemic in a positive way to restructure our policy, to restructure our aid, to restructure our relationships. So I want you to go 6 years out and write the next 5 years. I want you to sort of tell me that if you were sitting there and advising Joe Biden, looking at what's happened to the economy, looking at the rise of China, looking what's happening at, as you pointed out, sort of the rise of the authoritarians all around the world, we are not unique with Donald Trump. What would you do to craft a foreign policy that recognizes that on top of climate change, let's also understand that that's going to exacerbate the situation. On top of illness, we have environmental illness that doesn't look at borders either, just the way a pandemic. So in a funny way, the pandemic is preparing us for the acute problems of climate change. What would you want us to see in our behaviors? He's already saying, Joe Biden, I'm going to restore our relationship with the WHO. I'm going to get back to the Paris Accords. He's already saying, I'm not going to be Trump. I'm going to reestablish those relationships. But even reestablishing the relationships don't reflect what those relationships are right now. Look at the UK. UK just left the EU. So now are you going to be with the EU? Are you going to be with the UK? Do you figure? I mean, everything has already changed, even as you want to look at where you're going forward.
Well, what I worry about is foreign policy as bumper stickers or foreign policy as slogans. And the Biden administration came up with one that I have no idea what it means. Foreign policy for the middle classes. And Jake Sullivan, the new national security advisor on January the 20th, was on Fareed Zakaria yesterday. He was asked about that and he had to mumble his way through some kind of an answer. Forget the slogans. Get down to basic liberal internationalism. use the Security Council, which is why Franklin Roosevelt wanted the Security Council. In fact, it should probably be expanded to bring in countries that weren't important in 1945, like India or Brazil, that are very important now, and maybe even Turkey. We need a wider based Security Council and discuss the combination of climate control and this pandemic. Keep in mind that what Trump did, which I think was criminal, was going after this environmental legacy that Barack and Obama and Joe Biden were responsible for, that was designed to protect the lungs. And of course, Trump went after clean air and clean water and automotive emissions, all the things that attacked the lungs. That was criminal. So we have to get back to an international way of dealing with the climate, return to the Paris Accord, get back to the Iran nuclear accord. Nuclear weapons aren't the solution to anything. Nuclear weapons are nothing but a problem. Right. And they add to the cost of what we're doing. And it's very reminiscent of what President Eisenhower warned about in the Cross of Iron speech. Every dollar we take for a tank, every dollar we take for a plane, every dollar we take for a ship, we're taking a dollar away from children who need food or workers who need support. I wish that had been the theme of his 8 years instead of just one Cross of Iron speech. This is that moment. That's where we are right now. And if the pandemic can't get us to do that, I don't know what challenge or what crisis could force us into a more international way of doing business. But instead, if you look what the mainstream media is doing, they're trumping up conflict with China. Every time I pick up a Washington Post op-ed, I can't believe what Fred Hyatt has put into his newspaper, allowing people like Josh Rogan, who seems to know nothing about national security, to talk about the China threat. That's a self-fulfilling prophecy. If we want a China threat, we can certainly create one. And like World War I, we could sleepwalk into a war with China over Taiwan without knowing what we're doing. And if you left Trump in for another 4 years, that's probably what would have happened. But I'm not impressed yet that Biden has put the people in place who really can think outside the box. I think Jake Sullivan is very strong. He's obviously very smart. He's very articulate. But I heard the same old way of thinking about things. We can't keep doing the same thing that got us into this mess. It's what Lincoln said during the Civil War. We have to disenthrall ourselves. We really have to go back to the drawing boards as we did in 45 with George Marshall and Dean Acheson and George Kennan and Chip Boland. And Truman, for a guy with only a high school education, I think he had a good idea. He was well-read and he knew what we needed to do. Mistakes were made. Of course they were made. They will always be made. But they had an understanding of liberal internationalism. And if we don't get back to that, bringing all of the nations together, including Russia and China, we have to find a way to do business with them. Okay, Russia hacked into our internet, our unclassified internet. Some people are calling that an act of war. People who should know better. Senator Durbin called that an act of war. It was espionage. It's what we do to them. It's what they do to us. We have to get back to disarmament with Russia. We have to do this same thing.
If you write that op-ed in the Washington Post, it's not an act of war. It's espionage. It's what we do. It's what, frankly, corporations do it with each other. You know that. It's not an act of war. They want those trade secrets. And that's another reason why I wanted the vaccines to be open source. You don't have to hack an open source vaccine because we're all sharing with
the world. It should be open.
You said something at the very beginning of your eloquent conversation about the fact that Donald Trump attacked all these sort of environmental policies, whether it was water or air or clean air or the car industry, that he attacked our lungs. He kept saying he attacked our lungs. Isn't there an irony here that what does the COVID go after but our lungs?
Exactly.
And so I'm looking at this theme that is
COVID.
He's COVID. You were saying it was like a bingo. If you look at his last 4 years, they did attack our lungs. And then you look at what lands on his plate, but a pandemic that does exactly the same thing. It is almost a personification of the last 4 years of this man.
It's the perfect symbol for what we're trying to deal with. And Hillary Clinton warned us during the campaign. I can't imagine, she said, a crisis with Donald Trump in the White House. Well, imagine it. We're living through it. And yesterday's incoherent phone call with the Georgian officials. But, you know, keep in mind, these Georgian officials, they are political appointees. We've got to get away from political. Raffensperger did the right thing. Well, there's no guarantee the next time around that a Georgia Secretary of State will do the right thing. We need a bipartisan, actually a nonpartisan commission to handle our voting. We need a national system. That's what they have in Mexico. That's what they have in India. That's what they have in Bangladesh. We don't have it. There's so much we need to do. Biden realizes what he's in for.
My daughter lives in Shanghai. I now have a granddaughter that's half Chinese and half American. China is so emotionally connected to me, let alone politically connected to me, let alone economically. We already know you go into Walmart and everything is made in China. And frankly, we're beginning to see some of the problems now, even with getting the vaccines out, even with all these things. Look at the masks. Where are most of the masks being made? They were not being made in the Bronx, all right?
Yeah.
Talk to me about how we can embrace China, recognizing the potential threat of China, but also recognizing you get more with sugar than you get with a fist. So what I'm trying to figure out is, how do you negotiate a relationship with China? I've always said, for example, that, you know, China is talking about getting vaccines into certain parts of Africa, talking about looking at some of the third world nations, and they're going to help, let alone with infrastructure. So rather than seeing that as a threat, I've always said we should compliment China and said, we'll join you. How can we get the more vaccines out as well? Because we know that a weakness anywhere is a weakness everywhere. So in a funny way, instead of seeing that as something to be fearful of, compliment them, which is kind of a mind, you know what, and at the same time say, we'll replicate it too. And I'm just trying to figure out how you work with China so not everything is perceived as a negative, but in fact, you can sort of almost undermine them by saying, great idea, let's join you.
Well, the first thing you have to do is realize that China is for real. China is a power.
Absolutely.
That we can't contain China. We have this fiction that we contain the Soviet Union, therefore we'll contain China. Well, the Soviet Union was a third world nation that happened to have nuclear weapons. They were Upper Volga with nuclear weapons, as someone said. In fact, it was a Soviet official who said that. That's not China. China is real. So we have to acknowledge that. And the United States isn't very good at acknowledging that there's a rival power out there. So we have to learn to relate to China in a diplomatic way. And frankly, what we should start with by acknowledging we've been very successful. We've had administrations, both Democratic and Republican, since Nixon and Jimmy Carter, who conducted the process of diplomatic recognition, right. And their policies worked. What we wanted was to make China a stakeholder in the international community. Well, that's exactly what they've become. They're the second biggest donor to the United Nations. They're one of the largest participants in peacekeeping operations around the world. They've never used military force in an international setting since they used military force against Vietnam in 1979. What other member of the Security Council can say that? And we never acknowledge that. If China wants to be this stakeholder, and that's why they participated in the Iran nuclear accord, and that's why they worked with us when we were seemed to know what we were doing with North Korea. They didn't want North Korea to have more nuclear weapons. They agree with us on denuclearization. They agree with us on doing something about terror. They agree with us in terms of dealing with piracy in the Red Sea. Let's take advantage of that, acknowledging that, okay, we don't like what they do with the Uyghurs in the Northwestern provinces. We don't like what they do in Hong Kong. We don't like the pressure they put on Taiwan, but that can all be part of the negotiation. That's what we did with the Soviet Union when we made arms control the key to detente. And eventually we developed, even Reagan, who started out talking about the evil empire, engaged the Russians more than any other American president in history. And that's what we need to do.
So what's happening right now, you know, with the 12 senators that are going to be challenging the election result, the 140 members of Congress who are going to be challenging the election result, Donald Trump with that incredibly crazy phone call with the Georgia Secretary of State. Another way that we can also deal with China is to re-engage in our own democracy. Because right now they are pointing to everything that's happening here and saying, see why that fails? See why that doesn't work? See what's happening here? They're, you know, they're creating this monster, this coup. We have stability. You're not walking around in mess and socially isolating in China. We dealt with this virus. They could not. They didn't have the capacity to do it. If you want to effectively deal with China, you make sure that you have a vibrant democracy that addresses corruption, that recognizes that votes matter and they should be counted, because otherwise our democratic failure just enhances China's role in the world, because they're going to say, look what we can do, look what they can't.
The day after we left the World Health Organization, they doubled their contribution to the World Health Organization. And I agree with you completely, but I would add just one thing to that. Okay. We've got to get away from this fixed notion that we demand and we're going to have predominant military power.
I agree.
This predominant military power has gotten us nowhere. The fact that we spend more on the military than the entire world combined has gotten us nowhere. We don't have to be a global power to that extent.
I should always keep you on for an hour, but I'm just going to remind everyone, military power. Let's talk about the nutcase in Nashville who blew up his SUV in front of the AT&T building. Maybe he wasn't even intending to park it there. Maybe that was just the only available space, but look what happened to communications.
Oh, I think he put it there for, he was a conspiracy theorist. He put it there for a reason.
All the military power in the world didn't stop him from doing this. So yeah. You are absolutely right. We are thinking in the past when military may have had something. We are now living in a nuclear age. And frankly, we're living in an age right now where someone can plant an appropriate bomb. Someone can undermine, you know, an internet connection and completely devastate a state or a country. So you're absolutely right. We're putting our money in the wrong places. And we need that as part of our foreign policy.
Amen.
On that note, Mel Goodman, you just heard him describe himself. He wants us exposed to who we are, what we do. It shouldn't be classified. It should be declassified. It's how we understand our relationships, how we understand, even more importantly, Mel, our mistakes.
The way we get to the democracy you're talking about is through openness and transparency.
Absolutely.
And actually, the last few presidents, including Obama, they weren't friendly toward openness and transparency. You know, Trump is an accelerant of all of these terrible tendencies we're seeing, but there's a sort of a prehistory to all of this. So when you go after whistleblowers, when you fire inspectors general, when you deny the Freedom of Information Act and the use of it, you're hurting your democracy.
And I want to remind everyone that openness, transparency, sunlight, it cleans things up. It absolutely does. Yeah. And on that note, Mel Goodman, thank you for being the best first guest of 2021.
Thank you. Happy New Year.
Happy New Year.
Slovom Godom, as they say in Russian.
All right, ciao. Bye-bye.
Bye now.
All right, this is the first part of The Attitude with Artie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. We'll be right back.
Insight Daily Radio. Conversations with today's most influential authors, actors, musicians, artists, and creative minds. Over 10 million people have bought the book, What Color is Your Parachute? And this manual for job hunters has been extensively rewritten each year for over 40 years. The author of What Color is Your Parachute is Dick Bowles.
If people are not accustomed to being interviewed for a job, they always want to know what is the most important or what are the most important things that they should keep in mind when they go into the interview room. The first one is you have to let the conversation be 50-50. 50% of the time, you have to let them do the talking. 50% of the time, you should do the talking. You should have curiosities that you want to find out more about this organization and so on. A researcher at MIT years and years ago, his name and date of the research is lost in the mists of time, but he had this theory. So he asked all these recruiters, look back at all the people you interviewed during the day, look at the ones you hired, and look at the ones you did not hire. And instinctively, the recruiters always hired the person that allowed the 50% equation to dominate. And the ones that didn't get hired were either the people that talked all the time, the job hunters who talked all the time about themselves, because then they were presumed to be so self-absorbed they would be of no use to the organization, or the people that the interviewer talk all the time and said barely anything about themselves because they were assumed to have something to hide that they were anxious not to get into any discussion of.
Dick Bowles, author of the bestseller, What Color is Your Parachute? There's more online, insightdailyradio.org.
That's all you seem to do. Messing around every guy in town, putting me down for thinking of someone new. Always the same, playing your game, drive me insane, trouble's gonna come to that it won't. like a brush. It's fading away, can't feel you anymore. Don't care what you say, cause I'm gonna wear the snake. Gonna make you pay for that great big hole in my heart. People jumping all around, watch out woman, no love.
Welcome back to part two of the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Another reminder that we are Zooming on Monday morning so that it will air on Tuesday. I've been thinking about that phone call, that hour and 5 minutes phone call between Donald Trump and the Secretary of State of Georgia. And I've been listening to parts of it. It's horrifying. It's almost an hour and 5 minute monologue. I'm not sure he even let anyone sort of weigh into the conversation. He kind of believes his lie. You can almost feel it. You can feel sorry for him, but you could also be appalled that he's the president. I decided that all my friends kept telling me about how dishonest Donald Trump is. So I'm going to throw out another word. I don't think he's dishonest. I think he's ahonest. I think he doesn't have the capacity. I think if he was dishonest, there might be sort of a tinge of guilt. There might have been a tinge of sort of understanding what the real facts are and that he was lying to the American people. He doesn't have that capacity. How do you have that capacity when everything is all about you? Therefore, being ahonest is perfect because then facts have no meaning. There is no capacity to be dishonest. After all, he believes it. And since he, you know, l'état c'est moi, then we all have to go along with him. So as I was thinking about this phone call, I had an interesting conversation with a professor of law at Cornell, who's also a professor of finance at, where is it again? Did you say you were a professor Georgetown? Is that right? Georgetown. Okay. It was such an interesting conversation. I thought, okay, people are beginning to process this. And I decided to look at your Twitter feed in order to reach out to you since you hadn't written anything. And I knew that Robert Hockett was exactly the person I wanted to talk to. Before we get into your understanding of this conversation, or frankly, what we should do, at what point during the course of this conversation, well, that's indictable. Well, that's indictable. Well, that's indictable. I wanted my audience to know a little bit about you, because when they hear finance and law, they have this sort of knee-jerk response that you're probably working for Goldman Sachs. You might be, you know, offering some sort of assistance to people like Ted Cruz, but of course I wouldn't call you if that were the case. Share with my audience a little bit about who you quote-unquote consult for, because you don't just teach, but you offer your wisdom to folks on the political landscape, and I want them to hear who you offer wisdom to and in what arena you are sort of helping them understand how to navigate and plan future policy.
Great. Oh, well, thanks so much, Arnie. I would have that same reaction, I think, if I heard that that was what somebody taught or what they were sort of involved in. You can sort of think of me as one of those people, but on the other side, the kind of photographic negative of those Goldman Sachs type people. And what I mean by that is, of course, as lots of your viewers and listeners will know, finance in particular has been quite conspicuous, quite salient as a public policy matter over the last 12 years, if not longer, right? Even people who ignored finance matters and financial regulation, for example, and monetary matters for that matter, before 2008, don't ignore those things any longer. And so a good bit of legislation that's done in Congress and by various state legislatures concerns, right, the conduct of finance and the way finance works in our country and indeed in the global economy these days. In addition, of course, many public policy initiatives that are taken by the federal government and by state governments themselves have to be financed. This is the realm of what we call public finance. And there's a law involved in public finance, just as there's law involved in private finance. What I specialize in basically is that area of the law, along with the underlying financial transactions and financial modalities that sector of the law or that bit of the law is itself concerned with. most of the legislative or legislation related work that I do is for progressive legislators, either in the U.S. Congress or in various state legislatures, although I do occasional work for governors, mayors, city councils, and the like as well. In the federal government, it's been primarily Bernie Sanders, Elizabeth Warren, and Alexandria Ocasio-Cortez on the federal government side. And then on the state government side, I do a lot of work for several progressive legislators here in the state of New York, most but not all of it, with a very progressive, very forward-looking, very creative-minded, progressive state assembly member named Ron Kim here in New York. So that's kind of my background.
Well, I wanted people to hear that because I think it's really important, because knowing your history means that maybe some of your words will be even more valued by my progressive audience. So I just want to make sure they understood that. No. It's also important. Also, am I thinking of you? The congressperson that I am the most impressed with is Katie Porter. The reason I'm impressed with Katie Porter is that she does understand finance, yeah. Is that she does have that background. So when she gets up and starts questioning people from Goldman Sachs or whatever, they have to be terrified. Why?
Because she
actually knows more than them.
Right.
She knows what they are doing better than they know what they are doing, in part because complexity is the asset of the financial world. That's where it becomes so opaque that nobody really understands what's happening. And therefore, not only does the CEO of Goldman Sachs not have the capacity to explain it because he frankly doesn't know it, he knows the result he wants. And he knows that he wants someone that understands the logarithm or whatever it is that will get to this result. But getting there is something he doesn't have the capacity to understand. Katie Porter is so incredibly versed in this, the way Elizabeth Warren in the U.S. Senate was versed in this, that's what makes them truly powerful and productive members of Congress, because they get it, they know where the vulnerabilities are, and they recognize where public policy must step in to address it, because that level of sophistication also means that sometimes the Securities and Exchange Commission doesn't understand what they're looking at. Am I right about that?
Yeah. They both get the flim-flam. And it's sort of no accident in a way, because Katie, of course, was a star student of Senator Warren's when she was merely a Harvard professor. So she's a bit of a Warren protege, both pre-legislative career and, of course, now during legislative career. And that's been sort of their specialty, right? Both of them. You could say there's almost like a little brigade, you might say, of folk that I think of as sort of progressive finance folk. Some of us are academics, some of us are practitioners, some of us are both. I'm associated also with a boutique investment bank here in New York, but it's very much a kind of progressive-leaning investment bank. We provide a lot of expert testimony and expert sort of advisory services, often to legislators, to the good guys, the little guys, in litigation against big financial firms like Goldman, for that, for example. So yeah, there's a little group of us, I would say. And Katie, on the one hand, and Elizabeth, her mentor, on the other, are both, you know, sort of stellar members, you might say, of this big brigade.
We have to get into the phone call, but I'd have to share one story with you. I was the ranking Democrat on the Commerce Committee. Okay. This is the liberal progressive Arnie Arneson.
Yes.
And this was around the time of interstate banking and the idea that we were to embrace interstate banking.
Oh, mid-90s. Yeah.
Exactly. And so here I have the lobbyists for the banking community that usually followed. I would give testimony first because I was the state representative, and then he would give testimony as the lobbyist. I said to my chairman, no, I want the lobbyist to go first. Okay. But what they would do is they would sort of overwhelm you with paper that none of the legislators would read. They didn't have the people to do it. And they would somehow walk in as obviously they are the benevolent despot. They understand the problems. They can make it uncomplicated. They were able to sort of give to my committee everything that only showed a positive result. Well, I am the progressive that's challenging that. So as the lobbyist, now remember, this is the late 80s, maybe 88, 89. And the lobbyist is sitting in front of me as he's talking and sort of patting me on the head because he knows I'm going to follow him. And reminding him of his level of expertise. Now, this is, again, remember the time frame. I was behind him going, $100 an hour, $100 a year. And he didn't know why the whole committee was laughing hysterically. But I obviously wanted to remind them that that's why he was able to overwhelm them with paper that he knew they weren't going to read, because he had written the bill that we were going to sign. And he had written the bill. All right. I want people to understand how important it is to have this level of expertise seen by an Elizabeth Warren, seen by a Katie Porter in the legislative chambers, because it really does make a difference in what the ultimate policy is. Now, my expert, I want you to talk about the conversation, because I went to your Twitter feed and the conversation between Donald Trump and everyone was like waxing poetic. Isn't this horrific? Isn't this outrageous? And you said it's more than those things. There are things that are indictable. There are things that are criminal. And of course, the one thing that I thought was fascinating was in one of the tweets that you actually retweeted was from Norm Ornstein. And this is what he wrote. And I was like, I love you. Note to journalists, please ask GOP secretaries of states and governors in states, Biden won, if they have also had phone calls with Trump, Meadows, or other Trump lawyers or officials in the past week with any discussion of their state's votes or electors. I bet Georgia is not the only one. Yippee! All right, so talk to me about this conversation and what you see happening here, because we know he'll probably either get a self-pardon or have Pence pardon him, but that's only for things that affect the federal government, not for things at the state level, which is why Norm Ornstein's question was freaking brilliant.
Yeah, it was very heartening to see Mr. Ornstein tweeting to this effect. I've been sort of banging on this drum for a couple of months now, really since November 4th, the day after the election, and particularly ever since the weekend that Mr. Biden and Ms. Harris were declared the winners, because that's, of course, when the Trump people sort of went into high gear with this conspiracy that they've been engaged in for all this time. Let me say quickly, by way of sort of preface, that most people who have legal training, most people who are actually lawyers, including you and I, of course, are indignant about what is happening right now. And it doesn't really matter what your area of legal specialization is. This is basic law stuff, because it's basic rule of law stuff. And if there's one thing that actual lawyers are meant to value and to care about, indeed, their entire careers depend upon it and are predicated upon it, it is the rule of law, right? So this is one reason you're seeing even traditionally conservative or sort of rightward-leaning lawyers expressing intense indignation about this particular episode, and indeed over about the last 2 months, because this is a profound affront to the rule of law itself. Now, to the more particular matters.
Well, let me just stop you there, because a friend of mine, we were talking this morning, and she says to me, the lawyer and me can't wait to hear what the new attorney general says about 18 U.S.C. 241, conspiracy against voting rights. Speaking of the rule of law. Okay, but keep going.
Yeah, well, so we have multiple statutes on the books at the federal level, and most states have multiple statutes on the books as well at their own individual state levels that are all aimed at protecting and safeguarding the electoral process and the integrity of that process. And that has to do both with the way in which votes are cast and with the way in which votes are counted. And then in addition to that, there are significant bodies of law surrounding the kinds of things that people might do to falsify results after votes have been counted. Now, the primary term that you'll encounter under which most of these various provisions are understood and sort of described in one go is election tampering. Indeed, the word or the phrase election tampering is something of a term of art or a phrase of art in this area of the law. And indeed, oftentimes in specific statutes, you'll find the phrase election tampering referred to. That is a felony, right? Election tampering has to do with basically monkeying around with the results of a vote once a vote has actually been done or taken. Anything that you might do that would have as its object the changing of the count or the changing of the tally counts. There's all this talk out there expressing outrage at Mr. Trump as sort of being anti-democratic, being dictatorial, as being monarchical, as being a bit like a gangster, as having no principles, as being contemptible or beneath contempt, all of this stuff. You know, you see all these very distinguished people like Robert Reich, for example, saying, this is beneath contempt. The problem with all of this is, while it is true, there's no question but that this is contemptible, that it's dictatorial, it's anti-democratic, and so forth. It really dilutes, I think, the intense importance of what's actually afoot here. It's illegal. It's a felony, right? It's a frigging felony. In other words, if you convict people of this, they go to jail, right? They get sentenced to many years in prison. This kind of felony is a serious, serious crime. This is a felony under both national law or federal law on the one hand and under state law on the other. Furthermore, as Mr. Ornstein effectively pointed out yesterday, you can think of this almost as a kind of a variation on the idea that where there's smoke, there's fire. You can bet that these people who are engaged in this conspiracy are trying to hide it or making some efforts to kind of cover it all up. And that means if you happen upon one smoking gun, there are probably a lot of other bullets in cadavers out there. And this is essentially what Ornstein is getting at, right? If they've been doing this with Georgia, And if at the same time they've been saying that there are multiple swing states where I really won, well, you can be sure that they're trying to do the same thing in other swing states, right? Notably Michigan, Wisconsin, Arizona, Nevada. Ornstein is exactly right. We should be looking into what similar efforts have been attempted in these other states.
What Ornstein is doing is realizing, why did we impeach Donald Trump? Because of a phone conversation between him and Zelensky in Ukraine. You could almost take that conversation and the conversation with Georgia, put them side by side and say, what's familiar here? There's a pattern and practice. It's how he operates. I said to someone the other day, you're going to love me. When you retweeted Norm Ornstein's fabulous conversation about whether we should talk to all the other secretaries of state and all the other possible states that Donald Trump thinks were stolen from him, I said you could take the Georgia conversation and transcribe it and then turn it into a Mad Libs. I'm a genius. And take out certain names and then put in the names of the other secretary of states, the names of the number of votes. And you could have literally turned it into a Mad Libs. Norm was saying, Arnie, in her funny way, was saying exactly the same thing. And I'm like, oh my God, you are absolutely right. And he showed us, this is the bully he is. This is how he behaves. I want you to find this outcome, whether it's legal or not. I want this result, whether it's legal or not. I will threaten you. I will threaten you either with foreign aid, or I will threaten you with a re-election in the next 2 years. Whatever it is, nothing changes with him, except we refuse to call it what it is. This is indictable. This should be a felony. Let's call it what it is. You are breaking the law.
Yes, and it's a serious law breaking, right? Again, this is felonious. I get people saying that he's operating like a gangster does. Of course he is. What's actually important or salient about that fact isn't simply that it's odd or distasteful or aesthetically problematic that a so-called president is replicating the behavior of a gangster. It's that in replicating the behavior of a gangster, he's committing multiple felonies. This is indictable. It is incarcerable. This man is going to prison. I'm waiting, as just like you, I noted, of course, the similarities between this conversation on the one hand and the one with Mr. Zelensky in 2019 on the other. Indeed, I've been waiting for about, I guess, for about 12 or 14 hours now for tweets to start appearing wherein Mr. Trump calls this a perfect call. a very curious turn of phrase, by the way. I mean, even if these were not illegal, even if these were not felonious phone calls, one would wonder, what does it mean to call a phone call perfect? Does it mean there was no static? Does it mean it was not interrupted by a bad connection? What does perfection even mean in a context like this? But leaving that to one side, right, it's clear that in that call with Zelensky, there was a form of extortion underway. In this particular case as well, there was extortion underway, along with attempted bribery, and because they were offers of various benefits and the like. But then in addition to all of that, there's just the fact that you have to look at the object of what was he trying to procure here. And in this case, what he was trying to procure is itself illegal to procure. And that's election tampering, right? That's where the election tampering comes in. The other thing to note that we, you know, it's worth noting is that he has not been acting alone in all of this, right? He has a quote unquote team and he has various supporters. And you'll remember, of course, Arnie, that about a month ago, it emerged that Senator Lindsey Graham of South Carolina had been phoning up these very same people in Georgia, trying to obtain or procure the very same sorts of actions from them that Mr. Trump was. And of course, being a senator from the state of South Carolina, Mr. Graham has no legitimate interest in the conduct or proceedings of a state-conducted election, as happens in Georgia. He was engaged, in other words, in election tampering as well. If you go back to my tweets from a month or so ago, you'll find me tweeting constantly, once again, you know, banging on the dead animal, that he has engaged in, and I use the same phrase, felony election tampering. And you can imagine, you can bet that many others, indeed, what I would do if I were a special prosecutor or somebody in the DOJ, would be to investigate every single one of these House members and every single one of these so-called senators who are saying that they're going to raise questions in the certification proceedings this coming Wednesday to see whether they might have been doing stuff behind the scenes as well. I'm not saying that we know that they have or that they definitely have. I'm just saying that if you're willing to go as far as they're saying they're going to go this Wednesday, then there is more than a little possibility that you might have been doing a lot of this behind the scenes stuff as well, in which case you too have been engaging in federal election tampering and state election tampering. Finally, it's worth noting in that connection that there is no doctrine of legislative immunity or any other kind of immunity against prosecution for crimes of this character. We can imagine it's quite possible that something like 11 or 12 senators end up being federally indicted and having going to prison in the coming year. Multiple state officials, although happily the state election officials, irrespective of party, seem to have been heroes in this story, that they've been maintaining the integrity of their elections, at least after they've taken place. I mean, what they did to prevent Black people from voting is another story, of course. But at least when it comes to dealing with the votes that were actually cast and the counts of those votes, they seem to be resisting these.
Unfortunately, suppression is more subtle.
Yes.
Suppression means we don't want you to get in to exercise the franchise. Now that you've exercised the franchise, it reaches a higher level of authority. And now you actually have something that's potentially indictable. I'm thinking about Joe Biden. He wants to heal the country. There's this great divide. 74 million people voted for Donald Trump. My former guest reminded me 10 million more than voted in 2016, which is kind of horrifying that after 4 years of this, he could actually acquire more votes. You know, I'm thinking about the 140 members of the House and the 12 members of the United States Senate. The word traitor keeps coming into my head. They want to overturn an election. They want to ignore the ability of these states to be able to exercise the franchise, which is what the whole democratic system is premised on. Yeah. They want to ignore the results of this election. So, Robert, how do they get seated in the House and Senate when their behavior is one that is anti-democratic? It is a violation of my understanding of at least what many things in the Constitution wanted us to protect. And yet they are here to represent the nation. They want to basically sort of undermine at the same time. How do you have two masters? You either choose Trump or you choose the United States. You don't get two passports. You get one.
Right. A few things to say on that, I think. First of all, I mean, the first thing that's worth noting, because this is another important and interesting historical fact or occurrence that's been kind of forgotten. It's sort of forgotten to the national memory. 11 U.S. senators were ejected from the U.S. Senate in 1861 for refusing to recognize the electoral victory of Abraham Lincoln, who had won the year before. In other words, almost exactly 160 years ago, except this time it was post-March, because that was when inaugurations took place back then. But almost exactly 160 years ago, something very much like this happened. And it was the same people. It was people from essentially the slave states. And most of the objectors to Trump, let's face it, are people from former slave states, Jim Crow states, basically. The only difference, of course, is that the Republican Party just now is what the Democratic Party was in 1861. The Democratic Party today has become sort of what the Republican Party in 1861 was. So there's a sort of a reversal of ideology and values and commitments. But as far as the roles are concerned that are played by the two sides, we're basically back to 1861. We're not back to the 1960s or the 1980s or any other particular period. People are often tempted to analogize the present period to. We're really back to 1861. And these Congress members who are threatening to question the electoral results on Wednesday are basically firing on Fort Sumter. This is the Fort Sumter attack, basically, right? That's the first point. Second point to note, when getting to the sort of traitorous business, back in 1861, as today, the thing that sort of sets the United States apart as a nation state is that which constitutes us as a nation state. And what's unique about us as a nation state is that we are not constituted by a single ethnic group or a single language group, which was the original understanding of nation state 500 years ago, right? The original understanding of nation was something kind of vaguely racial or ethnic, right? So Sweden was the Swedish nation state because there were the Swedes, and this was a sort of ethnic category and linguistic and cultural category. Likewise with Germany, likewise with all of the other nation states before or apart from the United States. What really made us unique and still makes us sort of unique in the sense that there are very few other countries like this, and certainly no country is as large or as sort of significant in global affairs as the United States in this realm, is that we have never been a nation state in that sense. We've been a nation state by virtue of our constitution and our constitutional values. That constitution, as its name itself suggests, is precisely what constitutes us as a nation state. What that means in turn is that patriotism has to be understood against that backdrop. patriotism as an American is not what patriotism as, say, a Swede would have been in the 18th century, which is basically loyalty to your fellow Swedes, understood as, again, an ethnic, cultural, linguistic group, not as people who share a common constitution. Loyalty to the American nation state or to the United States, or not, you know, patriotism about the United States is basically patriotism about our constitution and the values to which it gives expression. That means, in turn, that one is not being simply pejorative or sort of talking for shock value or trying to be a bit colorful in referring to Mr. Trump as a traitor or as being, you know, engaged in some form of treason. And it also means that describing people who sort of ally themselves with Mr. Trump as traitorous or as treasonous or whatever is, again, not merely pejorative, not merely a sort of shock value or colorful exaggeration. It is simply literally the case, because there is no question. This is not even debatable, right? There are difficult constitutional questions that come up sometimes, right? There are legitimate questions where it's not clear whether the Constitution really takes us one way or the other. Then you can have good faith disagreements about what the Constitution actually mandates. And insofar as you have that kind of a disagreement, you're not necessarily a traitor or acting treasonously if you take one side rather than the other. This is not a situation like that. This is as cut and dried as it could possibly be, as evidenced, among other things, by the fact that in all 60 or whatever it is legal cases, the courts have laughed them out of court. They haven't even just said, you lose. They've laughed them out of court within oftentimes less than 24 hours or 48 hours of the suits being filed. These have been very largely or significantly Republican judges, including Trump-appointed judges. And then, of course, as we know, the Supreme Court itself effectively laughed this thing out of court, the suit that was brought by Mr. Cruz. When you have that kind of reaction, that complete lack of there being any legal doubt in the minds of actual judges and anybody actually who understands or knows or spends time with the Constitution, in a situation like that, there's not any room for good faith disagreement. And there's no room for both sides-ism or on the one hand, on the other hand-ism. This is just flat out anti-constitutional and felonious behavior, which, because it is anti-constitutional, is indeed treasonous and traitorous.
On that note, I hate to end on that note. I want you on for 3 hours. Thank you so much for joining me.
Thank you, Arnie. Thanks so much. The honor was mine. Thanks so much. Have a great day.
You're welcome. This is the Tuesday edition of The Attitude with Arnie Arneson and producers Dave Scott and Stephanie Collins. Stay healthy and stay well. We'll talk soon. Ciao. You better stay.